Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995, and the Walter S. Johnson Foundation.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, setting aside partisan bickering long enough to broker an overhaul of California's water system.
I see this not as a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. I think this is a California issue. And it's an issue about having enough water, safe and reliable water for the future of California.
But was the final agreement watered down? Also, state parks escaped the worst of Governor Schwarzenegger's budget slashing, but the Nixon cuts are adding up.
Californians all over the state have discovered just in the last 3 months what the department's been putting up with for a really long time, which is this roller coaster ride up, the roller coaster down, and it never quite equalizes.
Plus, turning blue-collar electricians' jobs into green-collar employment in the solar industry. It's the California Report. Well, if you had to pick one issue, just one, that's been at the heart of California's political squabbles over the last 3 or 4 decades, you'd be hard-pressed to pick a better one than water. And so, it was understandable that Governor Schwarzenegger was practically gushing Friday morning when he signed legislation passed this week to overhaul the state's aging water system.
People have fought and fought and fought, Democrats against Republicans, businesses against labor, farmers against environmentalists, rural against urban, the North versus the South, and this is how it went on and on. And for decades, this division have blocked California from investing in its water infrastructure. And so I'm very proud to say that we fought through those minefields.
The bills call for new dams and reservoirs, water conservation, restoration of the Sacramento Delta, along with monitoring of groundwater. And voters will be asked to sign off on $11 billion in bonds to pay for it. Needless to say, it's complicated. So we asked two people who follow these issues very closely to help us sort it all out. Jay Lund, professor of environmental engineering at UC Davis, and Peter Glick, president of the Pacific Institute in Oakland. I asked Peter Glick how he sees the package of bills.
I think without a doubt the worst part of this was the process. It was often put together behind closed doors in sort of the classic 20th century smoke-filled room approach. And even up to the last minute, things were given away. A lot of the potentially good things in the bill were given away. But I think time will tell as to whether in the end, it produces a substantial improvement in our water problems.
Now, most of the water in California is used by farmers, by growers. What did they give up in this package, Professor Lund?
I think it depends on where you are as a farmer. The Delta folks, I think, have a little bit more money for maintaining their levees over time. The San Joaquin folks have some direction towards moving towards a peripheral canal, potentially, which might help out with many of their water quality and water supply problems. The Sacramento Valley farmers, I think, have perhaps, again, along with the lines of a peripheral canal, perhaps some greater assurance that they might be able to sell some water and have a little greater connectivity with their brethren to the south.
And Peter Glick, whenever you tackle an issue like this and succeed, at least in terms of getting things passed, everyone has to give something up. Is it your sense that environmentalists perhaps gave up too much or didn't get what they wanted more than growers, for example?
Well, Scott, if I could answer your question about the agricultural interests, I don't think the agricultural interests gave up anything. There is a provision in this new bill that urban agencies work hard to reduce per capita water use by 20% by the year 2020, basically asking residences and commercial and industrial water users to improve water use efficiency. And that's a good thing. But there is no comparable demand that the agricultural community, which uses 80% of the water that humans use in this state, also improve their efficiency in a measurable way. I think that's a serious flaw. Did the environmentalists gain or give up much? There are some provisions for significant improvements in environmental flows in rivers. It's not clear to me whether those will be properly defined and adequately implemented, whether we're really going to see new ecosystem restoration in the Delta. I think that's the hope of the environmental community, and I hope they're right, but I don't think we know yet.
Now, I assume that even if voters approve these bonds, it's going to be quite some time before we see all the benefits of this. But we have some real short-term immediate problems right now. Shortage of water for farmers. The salmon season's been canceled for a couple years running. There's a pump shutdown in the Delta to protect the Delta smelt. Do you think, Peter, that any of those kinds of problems are going to be relieved by any of this?
Well, that's a great question. I do think a lot of the news and the hype in the last year has suggested that the ecosystem protections, the few ecosystem protections that we now see in place, are responsible for a lot of the problems in the San Joaquin. And I don't think that's right. I think the truth is we've had a bunch of dry years and the reservoirs are low and we've over-promised deliveries of water to many people. I don't think we have as much water as we've promised to give away. If next year is dry, this bill won't solve next year's problems. There will still be serious problems next year. If next year's wet, we might have a little more breathing room to help implement some of the things that I think we know need to be implemented. Whether or not we can save the Delta smelt, whether or not the salmon and the fisheries are going to survive in the future, still remains to be seen.
I want to ask each of you, starting with you, Peter, if you could add anything back into this package, what would it be?
Well, I would have loved to have seen really comprehensive water use monitoring and reporting. I would have loved to have seen a strengthened State Water Resources Control Board. I would have loved to have seen agricultural targets for water use efficiency. There's enormous potential to grow more food in California with less water. And I'd love to see a user's fee on water. We cannot pay for this stuff with bond after bond after bond. The voters may approve this coming bond, but we're sick of bonds. And so a fee would help solve the funding problem in solving our water problems. And that was cut out of the bill, too.
Professor Lund, what about you?
I guess I'm a little bit disappointed in some of the things that was taken out is a little bit of the language that is in earlier drafts that really recognized the need for some fairly major changes in the Delta and elsewhere. I think also another important thing is to develop a little bit more of a scientific basis for understanding how the water flows. We need to have more than just a pile of numbers. We need to actually figure out what this means and then figure out what kinds of water management actions are most promising and how the many water management actions that will be needed should best go together.
All right. Jay Lund, director of the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences, and Peter Glick, president of the Pacific Institute. Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
For all the celebration around this week's water deal, there was little to cheer about for people who use state parks. Budget cuts demanded by the governor started showing up this week. More than half of California's parks are reducing hours and closing campgrounds. Still more are cutting trash and restroom services. But even with limitations, visitors to Topanga Canyon State Park north of Los Angeles this week said keeping the parks open should be a priority.
When you want to just get away, that's where you want to go, is here. And anything away from the cars and pollution and smog, basically.
This is pretty much my favorite place in L.A. This is where I come to get away, and that would be a big loss to me.
Yeah, I'd be really disappointed to come back out here and find that they'd closed down trails. And, you know, they're already built. What's the problem?
Put a meter on it. Take credit cards. I mean, you know, there are all different ways to support services that people want. This is cheaper than the movies and more entertaining.
State parks were forced to cut $14 million this year. And as Andrea Kissick reports, years of chronic underfunding are beginning to take a toll.
It's my favorite place to go to hike in the Bay Area. It is incredibly wild.
John Wilkinson has been hiking these rolling oak and ponderosa-covered hills of Henry Coe State Park for years. One day a week, he staffs the visitor center at the main entrance to Coe near Morgan Hill.
You have a senior at $7. You know where you're going?
Yes, we're all set.
Great. Have a great day.
Volunteers like Wilkinson are being relied on more and more to help run the state's parks. The 69-year-old retiree is happy to give some time back to the parks, but he says there is a danger in depending too much on volunteers.
Rangers have a level of training which is far beyond anything that we can even imagine. We know how to tell people good places to hike. We can identify, you know, plants and animals. But we can't launch a search and rescue operation.
Because of its extensive backcountry, Ko will not experience part-time closures, but services like trash pickup and maintenance will be limited. The park lost all of its seasonal workers this year and shares five rangers with two other state parks. Ko has 87,000 acres to patrol, roughly triple the size of San Francisco. The park is down to one full-time maintenance person.
Every park has outstanding maintenance issues, and Angel Island has probably more than most because of the historic structures, and there's just so many of them.
Dave Matthews is the superintendent at Angel Island State Park in San Francisco Bay, which will be closing some restrooms and postponing field trips to cope with budget cuts. Matthews is driving me around the island in a golf cart past a World War II dining hall and a Civil War camp.
So now we're entering West Garrison of Fort McDowell, originally called Camp Reynolds.
Angel Island may seem like the crown jewel of California state parks, but it accounts for 10% of the park's billion-dollar maintenance backlog. While some buildings have been renovated, a majority of the 120 historic structures are waiting for repairs or have been left to slowly decay. Without a doubt, the biggest project on the island is the restoration of the early 1900s U.S. immigration station.
Over a million people were processed through here.
A large detention barracks where Chinese immigrants once etched poems on the walls has already been renovated. The next phase is a $15 million restoration of the station hospital, about a third of which has already been raised through state bonds, federal grants, and private money.
This is the front porch of the hospital, and the interior is kind of a hard hat area only because the walls are literally falling down, the floors are buckled because of water intrusion.
To continue with the restoration of this landmark place, it's likely more bond money will need to be raised. California voters have been receptive to approving park bonds for capital improvements in the past, but bonds don't fund daily upkeep at parks. That comes from the state's unpredictable general fund.
Californians all over the state have discovered just in the last 3 months what the department's been putting up with for a really long time, which is this roller coaster ride up, the roller coaster down, and it never quite equalizes or allows the department to take careful care of this park system, which is so precious to all of us.
Elizabeth Goldstein, director of the California State Parks Foundation, a nonprofit parks advocacy group, is walking back to her San Francisco office near Pier 41.
What we need to do is to find a way to create a steady, regular, sustainable funding source for state parks.
Goldstein's organization, along with other environmental groups, took the first step this week toward qualifying an initiative for the November 2010 ballot that, if passed, would double the state parks budget. The measure would tack an $18 annual fee onto vehicle registrations. In turn, any California driver could get into a state park for free. But not everyone likes the idea.
Why should some single working mom from South Central subsidize my use of state parks if she's never going to go there?
John Kupal is president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association.
I think there's a lot of sympathy for the state park system, but funding it through this mechanism really doesn't make a lot of sense.
Kupal says state parks could charge higher entrance fees. Park Foundation Director Elizabeth Goldstein says visitation and fees have gone up in recent years, but they don't cover the costs of running the parks. She believes parks are an essential service and should be supported like libraries and schools.
State parks is an extraordinary resource for all Californians, even if you never visit one.
Park supporters will decide by December if they will indeed launch a full-out campaign for a parks initiative. If so, they will begin collecting signatures in the spring. For the California Report, I'm Andrea Kissick.
When former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara died earlier this year, he left behind a complicated legacy. Many still blame him for the debacle in Vietnam. But McNamara's son has taken a different path. As an organic walnut farmer in the small Northern California town of Winters, Craig McNamara is challenging the old saying that the fruit never falls far from the tree. Mina Kim paid him a visit and files this report.
As Craig McNamara takes me on a tour of his walnut farm, nothing seems to give him more joy than animal dung.
Right below our feet is something that looks a little gooey, and it is. It's otter poop. One of the very neat things about this stream is it is filled with black otters. So what otters tend to do is they make mounds of their excrement just as a little sign, you know, stay away, this is our area, so watch your step.
For McNamara, the otters mean that Poudre Creek, which flows past his farm and irrigates his fields, is clean enough to support fish and other wildlife. That's something he worked with other farmers, environmentalists, and water officials to ensure.
Look at a little trout right there. See those two trout?
Being an organic walnut farmer, the trim 59-year-old McNamara is a conservationist and teacher. 16 years ago, he started the Center for Land-Based Learning, a nonprofit that teaches high school kids from mostly low-income neighborhoods about sustainable agriculture, water conservation, and the food chain. McNamara holds up an owl pellet for me to see.
We always show this to kids, and they just can't believe it. You mean there's a whole gopher in there? I said, yeah, look.
McNamara's eyes twinkle behind wire-rimmed eyeglasses. Despite a privileged upbringing as the son of a man who headed Ford Motor Company, the Pentagon, and the World Bank, McNamara says it was a motorcycle trip to South America in his early 20s that piqued his interest in farming. Today, McNamara says what he loves most is helping the next generation of decision makers understand where their food comes from.
That connection with nature. I love people. I love the basics of educating.
Though one of his more difficult students was his dad, former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara.
He never really got organic. And he'd say, I can't taste the difference. And I said, well, Dad, now hold on. You love tomatoes. Now you can really taste the difference in a tomato that's been produced organically. No, I can't taste the difference.
But when Craig McNamara decided to go into organic farming, his father backed the venture. In his office, a photo of his father at President Kennedy's inauguration hangs on the wall next to a poster for the documentary Fog of War. A smile spreads over McNamara's face as he remembers how much his father, a San Francisco native, loved nature and the California landscape.
My dad had this unique way of saying, "This is a glorious day, Craigie," or to whomever he was associated with. You know, he did take a robust enjoyment back to nature, and whether it was climbing Mount Banner or Mount Ritter or skiing down a mountain, he would find it just glorious.
But the Vietnam War tested McNamara's affection for his father. McNamara was a teenager when the war reached its height, and he was fiercely opposed to it. While in high school, he hung a Viet Cong flag in his bedroom, and as a student at Stanford, he was active in the peace movement. His ties to a man best remembered as the chief architect of a failed and costly war led to a personal battle that lasted into adulthood.
I have searched throughout my life for ways to balance my life and to find harmony with the things that both the gifts that my family have given me and the struggles that my family as offshoots provided me with.
For McNamara, teaching and farming have been a way to find that balance.
We're walking down into one of our reservoirs.
McNamara shows me his farm's tailwater recovery pond, which helps reduce irrigation runoff and prevent silt from flowing into the creek. The pond has become home to native plants and birds and deer, as McNamara points to a small mound of deer droppings near its banks.
There's a stream that runs through my life, directly connected to my father, that both emanates from lessons learned from him, but also some of my reactions to the choices that he made and choices that I've made to make a better society for all of us.
Craig McNamara was at his father's side when he passed away in July. For the California Report, I'm Mina Kim.
There was more grim economic news Friday as the national unemployment rate rose to 10.2%, and in California, it's even worse. As the economy continues shedding blue-collar jobs, many are seeing green, the green economy, that is, where new job opportunities are emerging. This weekend, an electricians union is hosting a training to teach its members how to install solar panels. From KUSP in Santa Cruz, Christopher Connolly reports.
Thank you. Wayne Houston is putting the last few pieces together of brand new solar panels that are being installed on the Union Hall of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 234 in Castroville. The panels are part of this local's initiative to green their buildings and train their workers.
So here we have three strings of 12 for a total of 36 panels, and then they combine in a junction box here. They go inside through some components, and they'll actually backfeed PG&E. They'll backfeed our utility company, and in the daytime in full sun, hopefully that meter should actually spin backwards.
The IBEW has been training their apprentices in solar panel installation for a few years now, but they've started a new campaign to train electricians to be part of the green economy. Inside the Union Hall, Houston says he traveled to Los Angeles for his solar training.
It's really a very great experience to go through something like that and to continue my education as an electrical installer, because then I can, you know, show back up to our shop and say, hey, boss, I got this experience doing this. Let's go get some of that work, and he can go out and get it, and everyone keeps rolling, and it's a win-win.
That ability to get green jobs is no small thing. On California's Central Coast, electrical workers face a 15% unemployment rate. Being able to do the jobs paid for by stimulus funds that are available for greening projects could mean the difference between working and not. With all the talk about green jobs and the green-collar economy, Paul Gutierrez, an organizer with the Electricians Union, thinks that the role electrical workers are playing is often overlooked.
The key component of sustainability is electricity. Whether it's smart grid, utilities, energy efficiency through lighting retrofits, daylight harvesting, photo sensors, as well as alternative energies, the wind generation, solar, hydro, it's all electrical based.
The solar panels that are being installed on the Union Hall are part of an effort to earn the building one of the first platinum ratings on the Central Coast by National Design Standards. With the building upgrades and this weekend's training, the IBEW is proving that green jobs are here. For the California Report, I'm Christopher Connolly in Santa Cruz.
Release of the movie version of the kids' classic book, Where the Wild Things Are, set off a controversy over whether the film was too scary for children. The California Report's pop music critic, Steve Hockman, had that in mind as he listened to three new albums of music for kids.
It's scary out there, right? So naturally, the instinct is to break kids in easily, to protect and shelter them, or at least distract them from all that. Sure. The problem is that it has led to some pretty sappy children's music in recent generations. Well, you don't have to be scared of that with My Trampoline, an ostensibly kids-targeted album by Peter Himmelman. I climbed a giant mountain. Well, it was actually just a pile of rocks. I crossed an ocean while I was taking a bath. I was racing a race car when I ran down a little path. Imagination, yes, it gets me through a dull day. Imagination, yes. Himmelman's an artist who has long confronted confusion and uncertainties on a grown-up level with a heady mixture of faith, brains, and wit. And all three come into play on this set. Play, of course, is an operative word, and Himmelman is very frisky with his turns of phrases and adult-friendly folk soul rock in such songs as Imagination, to which we were just listening, and Are There Any Kids Named Steve Anymore, which I'm trying not to take personally. But the clincher here is when he turns from playful to prayerful, in the looser sense, with the contemplative melancholy 10 billion blades of grass, a close-focused look at our place in the wonders of nature that soars like a Broadway showstopper. Just a smattering, suddenly a shattering, echoes from the earth, it soon gives birth to something so surprising, a billion voices rising, upwards and in mass, it's the symphony of 10 billion blades of grass. Of course, confronting youthful fears is nothing new, as anyone who's read Brunel Bettelheim, let alone the Grimm Brothers, well knows. And in a new album titled Cradle Songs, Bay Area women's vocal ensemble Kitka explores old, mostly European traditions of lullabies that, under the surface, may not seem so lulling. Yes, the voices blend with peaceful gentility and the words in Russian, Armenian, Bulgarian, Yiddish, Ladino, and in a few cases English, do seek to ease an infant into beautiful dreams. But the melodies often border on the mournful, embodying the very things from which a child needs protection. The reassuring quality seems to be wishful thinking from anxious mother's collective unconscious. Go to sleep, little one, so sweetly, so free from worry, they coo in the Georgian tune Kakuri Nana. In sharp contrast, the album Dead Man's Bones doesn't shelter kids from, well, anything. In fact, actor Ryan Gosling, the mastermind and main voice of this musical and theatrical side trip, brings in youngsters from the Silver Lake Conservatory of Music to chant along on such maybe too vivid material as My Body's a Zombie for You. Overall, Dead Man's Bones comes across as Leonard Cohen meets Oingo Boingo meets, oh, Glee. A strange mix, sure, but pulled off with accomplishment and panache. And if you've seen the movie Lars and the Real Girl, and if you haven't, Netflix it as soon as we're done here, then you know how well Gosling can portray an innocent dealing with the frightening world in a way that is truly charming. Think Jimmy Stewart in Harvey, transposed to our times. So even in the sometimes ghoulish Bones material, there's a disarming sweetness that rules the day. And in scary days like these, that might be exactly what we need.
Steve Hockman writes the weekly global music column Around the World for Spinner.com. He reviewed My Trampoline by Peter Himmelman, Kitka's Cradle Songs, and the self-titled release by Dead Man's Bones. That's our show for today. If you missed anything on the program or you want to share it with a friend, you can do that and more at our website, californiareport.org. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. Our interns are Susanna Kim, Mike Lee, Nicole Ely, Matthew Richmond, and Alice Daniel. Gabriel Cohen is the online editor. The producers are Victoria Malione and Nina Thorson. Dan Brecky was a contributing editor. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. Chevron, an energy company encouraging innovation right here in California. This is the power of human energy. Information available at chevroncalifornia.com. And the California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. Online at www.calendow.org.